is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suwuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's especially important that the UN continues to talk to and elevates its engagements with the civilian-led resistance movement, especially those actors with the Forces for Freedom and Change that have been leading the push for reforms. I think only then will it have the credibility to reach a negotiated outcome that will be accepted by the street.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, stressing the need for a UN role to bridge the trust gap between the two sides in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, ECOWAS has imposed new sanctions on Mali after the country's military leaders postponed elections. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Despite having the highest number of COVID infections in Africa, nearly 2 years in the pandemic, fewer than half of South African adults have been vaccinated. South Africa's government has been reluctant to order vaccine mandates, but private companies are stepping in to encourage people to get the jab. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Thousands of COVID-19 vaccination sites have opened across South Africa, but the flow of patients has stalled. From the peak of over 1 million vaccines administered in 1 week in August, numbers have plummeted to under 150,000 last week. The decline comes as the country fell far short of the government target to inoculate 67% of the population by the end of 2021. Florence Mosiani is the operation manager of the Parkhurst Clinic in Johannesburg. She says dispelling misinformation could encourage more people to get their shot.
Providing more health education to our community. Or why vaccinate? What is the importance of vaccinations? Education, giving more information will assist, will reduce those kinds of resistance and myths about the vaccine.
Companies are taking steps beyond public education. Discovery is the largest private health insurer in South Africa. The company encouraged vaccination of its clients by offering rewards points and cash back on life insurance premiums. In September, Discovery also mandated that its 11,000 employees be vaccinated, and the policy worked. Staff vaccination rates jumped from 22% to 94% within 3 months. Dr. Ronald Whelan is the chief commercial officer at Discovery Health and heads the company's COVID-19 task team.
Discovery is well-versed and has done extensive work over the years around the behavioral psychology and incentives and rewards for getting people to behave in particular ways and supporting those behavioral changes. But those behavioral changes only get you to a certain point. Once you start getting to the 70% thresholds, you need firmer levers to get people over the finish line.
Whelan said employees overwhelmingly welcome the mandate and the reassurance it brings for going back to work. But he said 2-3% of employees have remained resistant. As more companies introduce similar policies, legal battles have been raised, arguing it infringes on individual rights. The country is still waiting to see how the courts will rule on the issue. Safura Abdul Karim is a public health lawyer in South Africa.
We know from previous cases during the pandemic that these competing community rights to life and health weigh extremely heavily and can warrant the infringement of individual rights in certain situations, but particularly in the context of a pandemic as serious as COVID-19. So it is very likely that vaccine mandates will be found to be constitutional in South Africa.
Without faster uptake, the country's hard-won vaccine supply will expire. In November, the government asked Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, as well as the U.S. government, to delay sending more vials. The same month, President Cyril Ramaphosa warned widespread mandates were being considered. Abdul Karim says the government should have already brought in stronger mandates.
We've reached a point where our supply of vaccines outstrips the demand for them. So we need to get that demand back up so that we ensure that all the vaccines we have at our disposal are utilized and that we reach that goal of population-level immunity.
She says mandates can play a strong role in increasing vaccination rates if other barriers like transportation to clinics and time off work are tackled as well. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Mali's military government on Monday responded to West African sanctions by closing its borders and withdrawing ambassadors from nations imposing the penalties. Regional bloc ECOWAS imposed the new sanctions Sunday after Mali's military leaders postponed promised February elections. Kent Mensah speaks to analysts about the significance of the sanctions and standoff in this report from Accra.
In a communique following a summit in Ghana Sunday, leaders of the 15 ECOWAS countries effectively severed economic and diplomatic ties with Mali. The country said they are withdrawing all ambassadors and closing land and air transit points with landlocked Mali because they said the military's proposed five-year transition plan is unacceptable. International relations and security expert Adam Bonnar has lauded ECOWAS for taking strong action to enforce its charter.
The military, I keep saying, the military have no business in governance. If you want to govern, resign from being a military leader. Put yourself up to be elected. Campaign, spend resources, tell the people what you want to do. If they vote you into power, so be it. If they don't vote you into power, you keep trying. And let's not allow this type of impunity to fester on or come back again.
He also called on France to respect the authority of ECOWAS and stay away from possibly interference in Malian affairs.
France has not taken its hands off Francophone West Africa. And for me, this is something we should be looking out for, hoping that France would not interfere and you know, make it look like ECOWAS cannot do anything. If they stay away from this, I don't see how long the military leaders in Mali will survive this particular sanction.
In an address on Malian state television, a spokesman for the military authorities condemned what he called illegal and illegitimate sanctions. He said the military government will also retaliate by recalling ambassadors accredited to ECOWAS member states.
D'ores et déjà, sur la base de la réciprocité, le Mali décide de rappeler ses ambassadeurs.
On the basis of reciprocity, Mali has decided to call back its ambassadors in the various ECOWAS countries and to close all its borders to the countries concerned. The government of Mali wants to reassure the general public that measures have been taken to ensure the normal supply to the country by all appropriate means. Thank you. Innocent Badasu, an expert on regional issues, believes ECOWAS's approach is not the best. Instead, he said, ECOWAS should aim at winning the goodwill of the people of Mali and the trust of the coup leaders in order to restore constitutional rule.
Dialogue must be an honest dialogue to win the trust of the Malian military leaders, trust that would allow them to begin to think that their personal security is not at risk and that they can successfully hand over to a civilian rule and still have a life that is not going to be worried.
For the moment, Mali's ECOWAS membership is suspended, and members of the transitional authority and their relatives are subject asset freezes and travel bans. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
The UN Council plans to meet behind closed doors Wednesday in an effort to salvage Sudan's fragile democratic transition from the stalemate following an October coup and the prime minister's resignation. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Shalawi has the details.
Volker Perthes, the UN envoy for Sudan, said in a statement Saturday the UN-facilitated political process would seek a sustainable path forward towards democracy and peace in the country. Perthes pledged this process will be inclusive. Key players in Sudan, the military, rebel groups, political parties and protest movements will be invited to take part in the process, as well as civil society and women's groups. The Sudanese Professional Association, an activist coalition in the protests against former President Omar Bashir, yesterday rejected UN-facilitated talks to solve the political crisis, saying the effort seeks to push towards normalization with the military council and its authority. It said, a solution begins with the complete overthrow of the military council and bringing its members to justice. Joseph Siegel, director of research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, stressed the need for a UN role as an honest broker to bridge the trust gap between the two sides.
It's especially important that the UN continues to talk to and elevates its engagements with the civilian-led resistance movement, especially those actors with the Forces for Freedom and Change that have been leading the push for reforms. I think only then will it have the credibility to reach a negotiated outcome that will be accepted by the street.
Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, and the United States welcomed the announcement that the UN Interim Transition Assistance Mission to Sudan will facilitate discussions. They said in a joint statement, "We urge all Sudanese political actors to seize this opportunity to restore the country's transition to civilian democracy." The four countries stressed the need for a results-oriented process that will guide the country towards democratic elections in line with the Sudanese people's manifest aspirations. Siegel recommends the international community back up such strong statements.
It will need to be reinforced by actions. There will need to continue to be no recognition of the coup leaders as the government, no financial support or debt relief. The junta should be denied access to the sovereign accounts of the Sudanese state. And there should be sanctions on individuals and institutions that are supporting the coup.
UN Security President Mona Jul stressed the need for a unified position to combat the rising trend of military coups in Africa and pledged a constructive role in Sudan.
When people going out in the street demonstrating against military coup makers, when they know that the Security Council has expressed themselves on the need for a democratic process, I think that makes a difference for people on the ground. Make sure also that the UN speak to both parties, the coup makers and the civilians in Sudan. I think it's extremely important to maintain dialogue with both of them and encourage a democratic transition.
Prior to the military takeover of October 25, Sudan was governed by a sovereign council of military and civilian officials tasked with overseeing the transition period until elections in 2023. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok resigned January 2nd, 6 weeks after he returned to his post in a deal with the army chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, an agreement rejected by most political groups in Sudan. On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke with al-Burhan and stressed the need for a civilian government. Mohammed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
Aid agencies have ceased operations in a northwest area of Ethiopia's Tigray region near the border with Eritrea after an airstrike there late Friday killed scores of civilians displaced by the conflict. Gelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said Sunday that aid groups have suspended their operations in northwest Tigray. Humanitarian partners suspended activities in the area due to the ongoing threats of drone strikes, said the statement to the media. Reuters news agency quoted aid workers saying an airstrike late Friday on a camp near the Eritrean border killed 56 people and wounded 30 others. The UN humanitarian office told the AFP news agency that the attack in the town of Dadebita has caused scores of civilian casualties. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, the party that has ruled Tigray for decades, condemned the attack. In a statement Saturday, the TPLF accused the Ethiopian government of targeting civilians. It also accused Eritrean forces of attacking Tigrayan fighters in the northwest Tigray on the same day the IDP camp was hit. Ethiopia's federal authorities did not immediately comment on the accusations or the UN announcement on the aid group's withdrawal. But since the outbreak of the war with the Tigrayan rebels in November 2020, authorities have denied targeting civilians. The UN has been warning of worsening humanitarian situation in Tigray. The UN Humanitarian Office said last week that humanitarian agencies operating in Tigray have only one-sixth the amount of fuel needed to distribute limited food aid. It said they continue to face security, bureaucratic and operational challenges, with aid partners forced to reduce or suspend operations, leaving millions of people without access to life-saving assistance. Galmu Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A prominent British political figure and a former anti-apartheid activist has asked Downing Street to freeze all contracts with one of the world's leading management consulting firms that's implicated in corruption in South Africa. A report by a commission of inquiry into graft while Jacob Zuma was president from 2009 to 2018 says American multinational Bain and Company helped Zuma and his allies restructure South Africa's revenue service, SARS. The tax collector was subsequently plundered of billions of dollars. The United Kingdom government is one of Bain's biggest clients. Darren Taylor reports.
The commission, led by Judge Raymond Zondo, spent the past 2 years hearing evidence of Zuma's so-called state capture project. Its report says the former president colluded with top officials of the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, and private business people and companies to loot state-owned enterprises. The commission says Bain supported the appointment of Zuma's friend, Tom Moyane, as SARS chief in 2014. According to the report, the firm then helped Moyane devise a restructuring plan for South Africa's revenue service. The plan, says Judge Zondo, identified individuals at SARS for neutralization. The highly experienced tax collectors were then fired or forced to resign, to be replaced by people favored by Zuma and Moyane. For almost 4 years, billions of rands were stolen from SARS until Moyane was booted in March 2018. The South African government paid Bain about 164 million rands, today worth $10.5 million, for its work at SARS. The firm says it's returned the money. Former British MP Lord Peter Hain, originally from South Africa, says the US company does a lot of business in the UK with state-linked organizations, including school boards and health departments.
So I want the whole lot to say we will have nothing to do with Bain until the legal process in South Africa has been completed, any prosecutions of Bain pursued and concluded. Because, of course, what the state capture report under Deputy Chief Justice Zondo made clear was that Bain had been operating unlawfully. And I don't think a global corporation like Bain & Co. should be in a position where governments across the world are doing any work with it whatsoever.
Hain says South Africans should be outraged at Bain's conduct.
It helped turn SARS, the South African Revenue Service, from one of the best, most respected, world-class tax collecting agencies into something that was near bankrupt. Bain & Co., working alongside President Zuma and Tom Moyane, to dismember and render it completely ineffective compared with what it used to be.
The report suggests Bain ultimately earned 2 billion rands from its dealings with the Zuma administration. It recommends that law enforcement agencies investigate the firm in relation to contracts it received. In a statement last Thursday, Bain said the Zondo Commission's report mischaracterizes the company's role at SARS. It acknowledges it made mistakes, but maintains it did not in any way, willfully or knowingly, support state capture at SARS or elsewhere. But Haynes says the report casts a dark shadow over Bain.
It's got specialist consultancy skills, and its reputation is crucial to getting work. Now, if it has behaved so terribly in South Africa, and the state capture report by Judge Zondo makes it absolutely crystal clear that it has, maybe it's doing that in Britain. Maybe it's doing that in the United States of America. Maybe it's doing that across Europe or across Africa.
Hain wants governments and private corporations around the world to note the Commission's findings against Bain, starting with UK leader Boris Johnson.
He's now got to make sure Britain is seen to be leading the way in ensuring that Bain and company are acting according to proper standards and not getting on the gravy train of corruption.
The man who blew the whistle on Bain's allegedly corrupt dealings with the Zuma administration, former senior company executive Ethel Williams, is in hiding, afraid he'll be killed in the wake of his revelations. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Uganda has reopened schools for the first time in 2 years, marking the end of the world's longest school closure from the COVID-19 pandemic. While many welcomed students return to the classroom, a low turnout has raised concerns about the long-term impact on education. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
It is the first day of school in Uganda and students are checking in. Aside from food items packed for those in boarding session, other items such as masks and hand sanitizers are a must for those returning. Uganda closed schools in March 2020 for more than 15 million learners at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. At Grace Nursery and Primary School, a class is in session.
We are doing 5 set symbols. Who can tell me this set symbol?
But head teacher Nurses Divine Kakembo says not all have reported.
I was expecting many children because I've been talking to parents and they want to bring their children back to school. Yeah, but what I expected is not what I've seen. The number is still small. Parents are still looking for money.
Wakumbi Kauthar, head teacher at the Chitezi Center for Disabled Primary School, says the pandemic has changed the lives of many children.
Some of these children are now parents. They have to go work and cater for their children. Some others have turned to be heads of families because some families have lost parents. Others are earning. You can meet a child saying, for me, I have a construction site where I can get some money. So, such children are not likely to come back to school.
Kayaga Doreen escorted her 8-year-old daughter to the Chitezi school. She has concerns about money but couldn't hide her excitement. She says, I'm so happy. I've asked every parent along the way to bring their child to school. She says, the children have been home for a long time and they have been such a nuisance. They have grown, she says, and should be in higher classes. She says, my main worry was the tuition. After all this, while staying home, now we have to pay tuition. Where are we going to start from? Mary Goretti Nakabugo, the executive director of Uwezo Uganda, a not-for-profit working to promote equitable quality education, notes that the school closure has deprived many students of basic learning.
Even before the closure, 90% of them had not yet acquired the foundation. For example, reading is extremely critical. So this is the time for us to rethink our curriculum, our syllabus, and our teaching and learning. Can they read? Can they do basic arithmetic?
Uwezo says that considering the gaps in education that most children experienced during the shutdown, the majority of parents are keen on seeing their children return to school. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Host Cameroon came from behind to beat Burkina Faso 2-1 in the opening match of the African Cup of Nations finals in Yaoundé yesterday. According to a Reuters report, Burkina Faso played without their coach and 6 players, all testing positive for COVID-19. An estimated 45,000 fans were at hand as host Cameroon won at the newly built Olympi Stadium, preceded by a colorful opening ceremony against the frenzied preparations to get the 24-team tournament ready on time. The Confederation of African Football last month considered cancelling the tournament as multiple COVID-19 cases cast a shadow over events. In the second group game, Cape Verde began its Africa Cup of Nations campaign with a 1-0 victory over Ethiopia. Today's matches feature Senegal and Zimbabwe, Morocco versus Ghana, Guinea against Malawi, and Comoros facing Gabon. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington.